From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. Tonight, since 2006, Ignite Seattle has given Puget Sounders the opportunity to share their insights into a topic they're passionate about. Ignite organizers call it an exercise in distilled discovery that leaves you with a deeper sense of the community and possibility that surrounds you. The 25th Ignite Seattle continues that experiment. It took place at Town Hall Seattle on October 7th, 2014. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording. Ignite Seattle's Master of Ceremonies is Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. Here she explains how and why Ignite works.
Ignite started here in Seattle. It is now in dozens and dozens of cities around the world. It's a very unique format, super fun format, so you guys are really in for a treat. The way it works is speakers get 5 minutes, 20 slides that auto-advance every 15 seconds. Them's the rules. So everything has to just fit into that. What that ends up doing is condensing some of the cool topics into just these little explosions of inspiration. I think you'll see that if you haven't already. So the talks. Tonight you're going to hear about all kinds of funky things. I almost don't want to give it away. But kittens and bodybuilding and craziness. The speakers have worked so hard. They have practiced. They have poured their hearts and souls into these topics. And it really is a grab bag of topics. From the geeky, to the practical, to the very personal and even vulnerable. So as an audience, remember, you guys look really scary from up here. I mean, you are terrifying me right now. Yeah, these guys are coming up. Some of them, they've never been up in front of a crowd even a quarter this big before. So support them. Know that they've worked really hard, and they're here to enlighten you in a very cool and quick format. All right, well, we all know politics is pretty broken. There's a whole lot of messy reasons for it. Our next speaker has a solid idea on a first step to fix it. Please welcome to the stage Nick Rubin.
I'm only 16 years old, and while I can't vote for another 391 days, I've seen enough to know that our political system desperately needs fixing. And I'd like to talk with you today about where we can start and the important progress we can make before campaign finance reform gets enacted. So when it wants to, our government does a great job conveying to people the information that it thinks is important, like Surgeon General's warnings on the side of cigarette packages, like big speed limit signs on the side of the road, and like the ominous penalty of perjury warnings above the signature line on tax forms. What about the critical and fundamental information about our democracy, like where the people we elect get their funding and who may be influencing their votes? How does the government do with this score? This is a real problem. The amount of money being donated to elections climbs higher and higher each cycle. For the 2014 elections alone, over $1 billion have been donated to Senate and House races. This is crazy. And now, polls have shown that people really are concerned and they do care about the influence of money on our government. 9 out of 10 people believe that there is way too much corporate money in politics, and 8 out of 10 people think that the secret political spending is harmful for our democracy. So, what these and similar polls of citizens tell us is simple. Americans overwhelmingly support strong transparency and accountability reforms related to campaign finance. They want better access to this money in politics data so they can be better educated voters. So, how are we doing with transparency today? Now, when you want to find out information on who's donating to members of Congress, here's just a part of what you have to do. So first, you have to find the Federal Election Commission website, which is the government repository of the information. There, you have to find a search bar, wade through pages and pages of results, navigate through tabs, and, if you're lucky, find a tiny Excel button in the top right corner. Then you're able to access an Excel spreadsheet that looks like it was formatted in the mid-1990s, before I was even born. And this access to information is such a problem that several great organizations have expended a lot of effort to try and address this, like Open Secrets and the Sunlight Foundation. But they're both nonprofits that rely on the generosity of donors and volunteers to sift through this information and make it comprehensible. As you guys can probably tell, I too am very passionate about this issue. I spent my entire sophomore year last year creating this browser extension called Greenhouse. When you hover your mouse over the names of members of Congress on any web page, a pop-up box appears that lists their total contributions, small donor contributions, and top 10 industry donors. there's been a great response and outpouring. Greenhouse has been downloaded over 100,000 times, and there have been over 300,000 unique visitors to the website. There have been dozens of articles written about Greenhouse and the fight for campaign contribution transparency all around the world. This is amazing, but it shouldn't have to be this way. It shouldn't need to rest on the shoulders of a 16-year-old developer like me to inform the people about data the government is hiding. The government should be doing a much better job with this. After all, the government mandates the reporting of the data. The government collects the data, and deliberately or not, they've let the ball drop, made this data unusable to the average citizen. But is the government capable of doing this? The answer is yes, absolutely, wouldn't be hard at all. And we know this because they've done something similar with data related to government expenditures. In 2006, Congress recognized the people's demand for easier access to government spending data. So they passed and the president signed the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act, which in part mandated the creation of an easy-to-use website. The site is called usaspending.gov, and it does a great job organizing the spending data, providing easy-to-use tools like interactive charts and trends. And while there are all kinds of important ideas to address issues like the Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United, nobody knows when or if major campaign finance reform will happen. Providing greater clarity into these campaign contributions is something we can do today under the current system. This is what the people want. So I propose that we push for a law to do just this, a law that can be based off the 2006 law. We can call it the Federal Campaign Finance Transparency Act of 2015. The people overwhelmingly support it. The government has shown it can do it, so now it's time to push Congress and the administration to act on it. So I plan on starting a White House petition to call the FEC to make this data more accessible to me, to you, and to every American who votes. So this will be an important step towards fixing our democracy and restoring power to voters. The time is right, and I hope you all can join me. Let's make this happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. So asteroids get a pretty bad rap. They can collide with Earth. They can kill everybody. Our next speaker is going to tell you why asteroids are really our friends. Please welcome to the stage Caitlin O'Keefe. Caitlin.
Hi there. I'm Caitlin O'Keefe, asteroid miner from Planetary Resources, and usually when I tell people that, they walk away in confusion, but it would be very rude for you to walk away today, so you get to hear why I think asteroids are the most valuable resources in our solar system, and why I'm actually an asteroid miner. So in Seattle here today, we live pretty amazing lives. If everyone in the entire world lived the quality of lives we live here today, we would need 5 more Earths worth of resources, land, food, and water to make that happen. And if you remember from your history books, since the beginning of time, new frontiers have all been explored because of these resources. Columbus came to the Americas and the gold rush settled and built a huge economy in the West. But on Earth today, we are literally bursting at the seams. We are running out of new frontiers to explore and expand to. So what is the next logical frontier? I bet you can guess what I'm going to say. It's space. And in space, we have these wonderful gifts from the universe called asteroids that are the key to the prosperity of our future and our children and their children. But asteroids kind of are known, as Monica said, as, kind of threats to our globe. And like Bruce Willis did in the movie Armageddon, he saved Earth from a killer asteroid. But as our founder so eloquently says, Peter Diamandis, or our co-founder, we really see the promise and the peril of asteroids. So we realize that they are a great threat, but we also see that they are the key to unlocking our future. And we just need to access them in the solar system. So Planetary Resources is trying to do this here today in Redmond, Washington. Because we wouldn't even have an Earth to stand on today if it weren't for asteroids impacting our Earth and bringing some of these resources here to us today that we know and value for us to live, survive, eat, and also create commerce, food, and economies. Resources on Earth are really hard to get to because they have been pulled into our Earth's crust by our Earth's gravity. So over time, we've had to develop research technology to access these resources. But asteroids are no different. They contain these valuable resources, and this is an asteroid in my hand, and I could actually melt this and create refinery-grade steel. And there's millions of these in space. So knowing kind of a little bit about what they're made of, you might be able to think of on Earth what their value might be. We know what a bottle of water costs at the store. We know what a platinum diamond ring costs, for those of you who are married. But you might be asking, why are they valuable in space? Well, we're going after an asteroid that has more platinum on it than has ever been mined off Earth today. It's worth $300 billion. But that's not even the most valuable resource out there. The one we're going after first is water. Why? Water creates rocket fuel. All 135 shuttle missions were flying with a water cocktail. That's what got them into space. So if we could access fuels from asteroids, we could literally change the game and open up the solar system. Because it costs so much money to get anything into space because of the fuel you need to get out of gravity, our Earth's gravity well. This bottle of water costs $20,000 to get to the International Space Station to our astronauts. But the same amount of fuel that gets this into space could get you from the International Space Station 200 miles above our head all the way to Pluto. So imagine if you could refuel from asteroid-sourced rocket fuel in space. We're talking about a game changer here. You're on the space shuttle. You launch from Earth. You're out of fuel once you get to low Earth orbit. You refuel that big orange tank, and that allows you to go all the way to Pluto or putt around the entire solar system. So the value would be enormous, and it's literally going to create one of the biggest economies you could ever imagine on Earth, and we're not the only people who believe this. I'm sure you guys all know who Neil is, NGT. So what are we doing about this? Well, Planetary Resources in Redmond is building right now robotic spacecraft in order to go find and mine these resources in space. And we're basically doing what humanity has been doing since the beginning of time, just creating the technology that will allow us to access resources in that new frontier. And that technology that we create will also help us with the peril of asteroids by detecting ones that could be a threat to us along the way. So Bruce Willis can still fulfill his mission of saving Earth with our asteroid technology, but I tell you, if I was on that asteroid with him today, I'd tell him to put down the nuke and let's help make him the world's first trillionaire, because asteroids are our friends and they're going to open up the biggest economy imaginable for humanity's prosperity. Thank you very much.
So among all the wonderful things you have inside you are microbes. Lots and lots of microbes. Our next speaker is going to tell you a whole lot of stuff you didn't know and is pretty cool about your microbiome. Please welcome to the stage David McAndrew. David.
So our bodies are covered in microbes, and whether you like it or not, they're all over you. They're on your skin, on your insides, on your outsides, and pretty much everywhere you look. When you think of these overall, as a collection, we call all these microbes the human microbiome. So our microbes are very different in the different locations. So the microbes in my gut are different than the microbes on my skin, which are different than the microbes on my mouth, which kind of makes sense because they're all very different environments. And they all play unique roles in each location. So actually, microbe cells outnumber human cells 10 to 1. So in reality, in some ways, you're really only about 10% human. If you talk about genes, they outnumber us 100 to 1. So when we think about microbes, we sometimes think of microbes as being bad. You know, the reason we have antibiotics, the reason we wash our hands with antibacterial soap, and the reason we cover our mouths when we cough. But the majority of our microbes are actually good, and they're here for a reason, and they are here to keep us healthy. So our diversity is also affected by the choices we make in life. So industrialized nations and research is starting to come out to see that they're about a third less diverse in their microbiome than less developed nations. Now, pregnancy and birth is a huge area where research is happening in this field. So in the womb, a baby's for the most part sterile. The first time that they get any kind of microbiome is by their method of delivery. So the environment that you're born in and the way that you're born plays a huge role in your microbiome. So if you're born vaginally, generally speaking, you develop a microbiome that very closely reflects your mother's birth canal. This lasts for about 3 years of life. If you're born by C-section, it's turning out that your microbiome in your gut reflects that of skin, not necessarily your parents. So what all this means, we're not necessarily sure. When you're born and you're developing, your immune system's figuring out what's good and what's bad. And research is being done to try to figure out what all this means. So some researchers suggest that it plays a huge role in non-communicable disease, things like obesity, things like asthma, allergies. But it's all really new, and no one's necessarily completely sure. One thing to be aware of is C-sections are increasing around the world. So in some countries and in some areas of the world, 50, even 90% of births are happening by C-section. So this is an area that could be important as more and more is learned about it. So some of this has even led researchers to make some pretty bold moves. There's something going on called seeding, and there's actually government-funded research that's supporting it. Basically, what happens in seeding is a baby that's being born by C-section, the mother will have a swab inserted into her birth canal during the procedure, and the first thing that hits that child is the swab, and thus seeding the baby with its natural microbes. This is usually the part my wife starts to shake her head. But seeding or not, there's other things you can do to kind of increase your child's natural microbiome. Things like breastfeeding, things like direct skin-to-skin contact, and even considering the use of antibiotics are all things you can consider. So it's getting cheap and easy to get this information. So right now I could take a swab of myself, send it in for less than $100, get an idea of what my gut or any other area of my body or yours microbiome looks like. There's even products coming out like probiotic baby formulas. There's even prebiotics for babies, which a prebiotic is something that the baby can't digest but is only in place for the microbes to thrive and live off of. So we pass a lot down to our kids, not just our good looks and our fashionable sense of style, but also our DNA and our microbiomes, and the choices that we make have large effects on possibly their future health. So sometimes we think of germs as a bad thing and a negative thing, but it may be time for us to shift our thinking and embrace what germs are and what they do for us. But one thing to remember is a lot of this research is new, and it's something that time still needs to figure out. 10, 20 years ago, this knowledge wasn't even around. But as it develops, stay on point, keep reading articles, and you'll learn more and hopefully be a part of the conversation. If this kind of stuff is something that interests you and you want to learn more, I invite you to join our meetup group, the Consumer and Personal Genomics Meetup Group, where we talk about the way that genetics and all this kind of stuff is changing the world around us. I'm David McAndrew, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, David. So our next speaker has spent more than 1,000 hours on the computer, many of them very early in the morning, doing not work. And he's going to tell you what he does and why it's awesome. Please welcome to the stage Jason Preston.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you. So let's talk about esports. Esports means competitive video game playing, often in a team, sometimes for money, always for fun. So I want to do three things here tonight if you're here in the audience or watching the video later. If you're not aware of esports, I want to tell you a little bit about it, why it's cool, why it's happening, why it's growing so much right now. If you are a fan of esports, I want to give you some things to use in conversation at cocktail parties. And third, I'm going to tell you what happened to my beard. So let's talk about me. If your schedule looks anything like mine, like I like to play video games, I'm into esports, I want to play it. But this is probably kind of what a day looks like. And if you want to add something to it, the only logical thing to do is to sleep less. So that's what I've been doing. I get up at 5 a.m. I've been doing this for about 6 months. And I get online and I play video games and I actually stream it on something called Twitch. You may have heard of it because Amazon bought it for $1 billion in cold hard cash. When I stream, this is kind of what it looks like. It's a fun thing to do. There's 20 or so people that watch me. I've built a little program in the chat that lets them do things like make me wear the ridiculous fedora that you see. I also had a standing rule for a long time where if I had 75 people show up as viewers at the same time, I would drop everything and shave my beard. Turned out that one of the people in the audience was a streamer himself with a large audience, and he told that audience to get their butts in there and make me shave. So that's what happened. So now that we've gone through that, an important thing to understand about esports is that I'm one of many people. There are lots of me's out there. That's a full key arena, and those people just want a video game. Like, that's what's happening in that photo. And a way to think about this and put it in perspective is to think about Twitch that I just mentioned. So this guy is Emmett Shear. He's the CEO and founder of Twitch, and he is a gamer, which is why he understood that watching people play video games and playing video games in front of an audience in a live stream was something that would be fun and entertaining. So when you go to Twitch, the page will it'll look like this. This happens to be the page of a professional Counter-Strike gamer. You can see, maybe or not, that it's about 6,000 people watching him stream right now. And when I took the screenshot, you can see a little subscribe button there. People can pay $5 a month to get some funny icons in the chat and basically support him. Half of that goes to Twitch, half goes to him. There's also ads that he can play, and Twitch splits the revenue on that again. So there is enough people streaming and watching that Amazon did the math and said, yeah, that makes sense. Esports doesn't necessarily mean any game. Generally, it means competitive games. StarCraft, Counter-Strike are sort of just epitomize, they helped begin the genre. And like anything that is competitive in a sport, there's equipment stuff too, right? So I came home and I said to my wife, I said, we need a new keyboard. I need a new keyboard. She said, why? You just got a computer. It came with a keyboard. And I said, because I want to hit more than 3 keys at once. That's a feature. You didn't know that. There's a monitor that has 144 hertz refresh rate. And that means, in plain English, that it draws pictures twice as fast as the other guy's monitor. Does it matter? Yeah, of course it matters. It's like the full body swimsuit that Michael Phelps wears while he's driving drunk, you know? It's it's important, right? So the question is, does it make a difference? And yes, and is it worth it? I think yes. It's actually a growing field. The International is a tournament that happens here in Seattle once a year. It just happened in July at Key Arena. And you guys have probably heard of the Kentucky Derby. You've probably heard of the US Open. That's the tennis tournament that happens in New York. And the prize pools, let's just kind of put things in and see how it looks. The Kentucky Derby prize pool is about $2.2 million. That's the purse. US Open singles, that's men's and women's, $9.5 million, and the international's at 11. So how do you get a prize pool that big for a video game? Well, the makers of the video game, Valve, seed the pot with, $1 or $2 million, and then they sell a digital item to the people who are fans of the game and who play the game. And the revenue from that digital item, the GIF and JPEG and various, add-ons that go into the game, contribute to the prize pool. And there's enough people doing that that it makes an $11 million prize pool. So to put it in perspective again, a little over 20 million people watched the International this year that happened a couple months ago. About 100 million people watched the Super Bowl. That's a fifth of the size of the Super Bowl for something that's a video game. And when you look at it that way, you think it's not actually that ridiculous that places like Robert Morris University are offering $500,000 in scholarships to people that want to go there and play esports. And Ivy League universities are offering intercollegiate esports leagues. This is a really cool, growing field. And I think it's something that you all should check out either as a spectator or as a participant and have fun doing. So if you want to check me out, I stream at everything Watch Spade is my video game stuff. So check it out if you want. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. So some of you might be familiar with what's called the imposter syndrome. Our next speaker is going to tell you how she got over it. Please welcome to the stage Hannah Brooks Olson.
Hey, guys. Hello. So for the, 7 of you, maybe, who have not heard of imposter syndrome, I can explain it to you. It's basically this feeling that a lot of people have that nothing that they do that's, good in the world is because they are good at things. It's also called fraud syndrome. And I feel like this all of the time. I feel like this now in front of you all who are like watching me stand here. I feel like this in the workplace. It's pretty common. It's so common, and I have felt it for so long that before I knew that it had a name, I made up a name for it. And the name I made up for it is Two Kids in a Trench Coat. Because that's really how I feel. Like, when I feel like an imposter, I feel like a pair of toddlers with a beard on asking Mel Brooks to open a bank account. And he asked me what the bank account number is, and I say 7. So if you haven't watched The Little Rascals, maybe that doesn't make sense. Maybe that's generational. But this is the name I made up for it. Because this is the best way that I've been able to come to describe what imposter syndrome feels like to me. In preparation for this talk, I Googled it just to see if like anyone else had ever described it that way. They had not, so the cheese stood alone on that one. I did find this amazing graphic from TVTropes.org, which I guess makes TV tropes, writes them up. It's like a wiki for TV tropes. And this one is called Totem Pole Trench. That's the name of it. And it's in like some things. It's apparently not as common as like my child brain had logged it away into thinking. And part of it, I guess it's part of something larger called the conspicuous trench trope, which is, by the way, not to be confused with the badass long coat. Okay? It's not that. It's not that, right? So these are the things that you learn when you're like deep Googling at night and you're super nervous to talk in front of a bunch of people. So Two Kids in a Trench Coat is, do you like my graphics? Isn't that good? It's like 70% of people, according to studies dating back to the 1970s, feel it. 70% of people, right? And women feel it way more often than men. They feel it more deeply and more acutely, which is, I'm pretty sure, like a talk that's its whole other thing. And the most important thing I think about it is that it's not a personality trait and it's not something you're born with. It is something that you are conditioned to feel, which means that something about what's going on with the way we treat people in the workplace is convincing 70% of us that we don't know what the hell we're doing. Like, that we are frauds in everything that we do. So there has to be something to that. Like, there has to be something that's going on. And my theory about it is that we set up this idea that there are experts and then there's you. Oh, that's me, by the way. By the way, if you've ever felt this way, great job, because highly motivated people suffer from it way more than lazy people. So if you've never felt like an imposter, you might want to try a little harder. So This is what I think most people feel like, right? There's like this little portion of experts and they know everything, and then there's like you, and you're just like bumbling through the world and trying to convince people that you're like a worthless, like, or that you're worthwhile, right? So that's you. You're a sad emoticon. But I think this comes from this idea, and especially for those of us who work in new media, right? I work in new media. I'm like a social media dork, and I run a little website. It's called Seattleish, by the way. So people, when you rank expertise, right, you often ask, like, okay, you need, like, 10 years of experience, right? 10 years ago in 2004, these companies were founded. This is what happened in 2004. So 10 years, that guy was founded in 2004. So 10 years of social media experience is insane. Like, that's a literal lifetime of social media. So if you think that 10 years makes an expert, like, look around. 10 years ago, I was figuring out the perfect aim away message. Like, that's what 10 years means. These are actual headlines from 10 years ago. This is from the New York Times. Should your PC be your telephone? Okay? This is what was happening 10 years ago. So if you think that the only people who are experts are people who have, like, 10 years, and I just picked 10 years because I think that's what, like, an HR person would say. Yeah, social media, look at this. Target only joined Twitter in 2009. I joined in 2009. Hey-ho, what up, guys? People have only just gotten to this, right? So it's not so much that there's experts and then there's everyone else. It's that there's a lot of people, and then there are people who tell their self-doubt to just shut it. Because that's really the difference. It's not a duration thing. It has to do with how much you can kind of get outside of it and how much you can look at yourself in your trench coat and be like, oh, yeah, like, okay, I'm pretty convincing as an adult. Because that's what everybody else is doing, too. Right? Everybody else is doing that, too. Like, you're not the only fraud. We pretty much all are. And anyone who will tell you there's that they're an expert is trying to sell you something. So my advice is, do confuse it with the badass long coat. Be the badass long coat, because a duster is like a jacket, only longer, thicker, and far more badass. So, do that.
Thank you, Hannah. So you've all probably noticed that drones are kind of having a moment.
Our next speaker is going to tell you why. Please welcome to the stage, Matt Schaub.
Thank you. So I'm a pilot, and I have this angry cockpit selfie as proof, so that's the best I can offer you. I'm amazed, and I've always been amazed by flight ever since I was a kid. It gives you these incredible opportunities to do things, see things. I landed that plane on a beach over near Ocean Shores. There's actually an airport there. You get a different perspective on the world from up high, and it's kind of a an amplifier of human capabilities. And it's been something that's been amazing to me for a good long time. And I also work on the web. I've been a pilot. I've been working on the web a little longer than I've been a pilot. And this gray box launched a tidal wave of innovation years ago that has continued to crest ever since. And here we are in 2014, and we're all carrying these devices in our pockets, which are 100 or 1,000, to the factor doesn't matter, times more powerful now than the stuff that was displaying that gray box way back when. This is another amplifier of human capability. And the network they connect to is amazing, and it's creating new opportunities. Now, that didn't always used to be that way, because this used to be where the computing power, it was all centralized. It belonged to governments, corporations, institutions, wasn't accessible to individuals, wasn't at human scale, wasn't at individual personal scale, until these came along, the IBM PC, the Apple II, the Commodore 64, I got you over there. The individualization of this technology made it possible for all of us to create, compute, and collaborate in a way we hadn't before. It democratized access to technology. And that happened around 1981, or so, give or take. And I think drones are having their 1981 moment here in 2014. If you go do a web search right now, or you go look on Kickstarter, you'll see really incredible projects by individuals, by bigger companies, everywhere here and there and in between. But the thing is, when I say drone, this is probably what most of you pictured. Something that is either a hunter killer, or it's peeping in my bedroom window, or otherwise has been part of the media narrative over the last 10 or 15 years of this thing that's centralized, part of a government organization, not belonging to us, the people, the creators. Well, there are some things going on out there I want to let you know about, like this. This is a concept for a drone you wear around your wrist. You're somewhere out there interesting. You press a button, the wings snap out, it flies away from you, it flies back, and it gives you a drone selfie, a droney. Here is footage actually taken at a high school football practice in Jackson, Mississippi. Coach's assistant said, hey, what if we put a camera up above the players, shoot some footage? The coach saw this, thought, this is amazing. I can watch plays develop. And they're going to use it for future practices. Now, the good folks in Minnesota back in February, a convenience store said to fishermen, give me your GPS location. I will send you beer. And this worked in February of this year. They trialed it. It worked. And the cloud is what enabled that. The fisherman with smartphone says, here's GPS, send me what I'm looking for. And that's going to start to happen at scale. And there are so many other things, because of what's happened with the smartphone revolution, that this is going to enable. Now, let's look at some more industrial-type applications. So here is a vintner, somebody in agriculture, launches this fixed-wing drone. It knows how to fly the four points of this field very quickly and efficiently with a high-definition camera, captures imagery about that field. When the drone lands where it was launched, uploads that to the cloud, it comes back down, becomes a report that you can act on. Scaffolding. Why bother with scaffolding when you can tell a drone to go fly around this smokestack or steeple, go fly circles around it with a high-def camera and do inspection that you'd otherwise have to have done by hand. Delivery. So you've probably heard about Amazon's possible plans there at Google's as well. Well, DHL's already experimenting with this, with sending medical supplies to Channel Islands off the German coast. And there are also other companies looking at doing delivery in the developing world where roads are terrible. Legal implications. So the FAA says, wait a minute, commercial operations are not allowed. We're going to have to figure out how to share airspace between drones, commercial aircraft, and everybody else. We'll get to it by 2016. Ixnay on the beer guys. So they had them take down their video. But then a federal judge comes along a couple months later, says, not so fast. You don't have jurisdiction. Let these folks go out and innovate and figure this out. So it's kind of murky right now. I'm not going to get into the details, but the bottom line is, it's kind of unclear how this is all going to work out. Companies are working on it anyway. So anyway, last week at this thing called the GeekWire Summit, Chris Anderson, CEO of a company that's trying to be the Android for drones, 3D Robotics, said the peace dividend of the smartphone wars is all this technology advancement in our pockets. And it's enabling all these new capabilities. Now, the thing is, I've talked about an amplifier for human capabilities, and I've shown you drone selfies and beer delivery. But the thing is, It's up to us, we the creators and the consumers, to amplify the kind of human behavior and the kind of things we want with this technology. And like the PC, it belongs to us now. And why am I standing on stage talking to you about this when I should be building a drones business? I don't know, but I hope you're excited about it, and we'll go do something yourself. Thank you.
So our next speaker is going to tell you how a childhood passion for Star Wars intersects with interactive art. Megan, take it away. Megan Trainor.
Thank you. Hi. hello, Ignite. I've suddenly come down with imposter syndrome, and I'm very nervous, strangely. But I'm going to talk to you tonight about embracing the passion behind great works of interactive art. I'm just going to pause here for a moment. I started out as a child, really passionate about Darth Vader. This is my homemade Darth Vader costume. And so this idea of like wearing black and interacting with technology has just kind of stayed with me the whole time. And I will talk about highfalutin things like physical computing and interactive art, but really I just want to be a Sith Lord. So I'm a digital artist, and that intersects with interactive art, but there's some, you know, everyone loves a Venn diagram, right? So not all interactive art is digital. But a lot of it is. And it started in 1925, Marcel Duchamp, you know, all hail. There's a lot of things you could say about this piece, but the most important thing to me is the idea that there's a button and you push it and you're an agent in the artwork. And there's something, again, so deeply about the human experience that is the artist asking you to come in and be a part of it. This is Danny Rosen's Wooden Mirror. It's an iconic piece of interactive art. And this follows the sort of general trope of interactive art where you have a video pointed at people and something else is happening. But again, not always involving electronics or cameras. This is Ligia Clark's dialogues piece. She's a neo-constructivist, part of the Tropicalismo movement, pardon my Portuguese. So here we have interactivity, but it's mediated not through machines. This is Condensation Cube by Hans Hacke. Again, you might not think of this as interactive art, but really what it's doing is it's reflecting what's happening in the room. It's reflecting temperature, it's reflecting human presence, the way the water moves inside the cube is no less interactive than a camera pointed at a room. This piece by Gordon Pask is part of the Cybernetic Serendipity piece, or gallery show in 1968, and the interactivity here is really between these different entities. It's sort of a robotic interactive piece. This is Sabrina Raff's Grower. Again, like Hans Hacke's Condensation Cube, we're looking at the carbon monoxide levels in the room, and this robot is literally creating a garden based on those levels and reporting what the humans are doing in the space. The robot is the garden. This is Rafael Lozano-Hemmer. I always mispronounce his name. This is Pulse Room. And so this is a piece where your heartbeat fills the space with luminosity, right? That your heartbeat is amplified into this room. This is Text Rain. This is a piece by Camille Utterbeck. And this is sort of, again, the standard trope of interactive art where you've got a video screen and there's something happening and you're playing with text. But that's sort of a problem, you know. You have these sort of people and they're trying to figure it out. There's sort of a gamification that happens with interactive art. But this piece by Gary Hill, this was at the Henry last year, it's called Withershins. It's this maze and you travel through it and you trigger sound. And in those kinds of pieces, people get sort of confused and they it's sort of gamified for them. They're trying to figure it out. So what he did is he just said, here's a map. Here's a bunch of post-it notes. Here's everything you're going to find as you walk through it. If you need to figure out what's going on, here it is. But don't be distracted. Just go back and enjoy the artwork. Robert Rauschenberg in 1968, Open Score. Let's put some, you know, radio receivers on tennis rackets and make tennis into sound art that turns off lights. Not quite sure what that's about, but worked for people. If we think back to Ligia Clark's dialogue piece, here we have a dialogue happening between Montreal and Paris. Like, let's just look at each other through the same tube. It's the same exact interaction, right? Let's look at other forms. So we've got heartbeats, right? We've got other human interactions. Let's take brainwaves and just turn them into like a kaleidoscope on the ceiling. Why not? Who doesn't love brainwaves? We start to get towards telekinesis, kind of a Darth Vader thing, right? And finally, this piece is this is Osmos by Char Davies. It's sort of the best-known virtual reality artwork in the world. It's a hard piece to document or show, and it's got sort of the standard headset, but what's really exciting for me about that is that it uses lung power to navigate, so your breath is what moves you through the space. This is my work. This is me experimenting with interactivity. This is from a show called Northern Electronic Research Division, or NERD. This is another piece called Ex Voto Machina. It's hard to explain quickly, so just... Okay, so I'm using brainwaves, and I'm reading Rudyard Kipling into a dual rack and pinion system I've made on a laser cutter with this encaustic fabric. Because Darth Vader, I don't know. That's all I got. All right, thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Megan. Our next speaker is going to tell you a story about how she came across what she thought was her kryptonite. Please welcome to the stage Candace Faber. Candace.
So when I was growing up in Federal Way, Washington, I had three pretty ambitious dreams for my life. I wanted to go to a top university, I wanted to see the world, and I wanted proof that my life mattered. It was kind of hard for me to get those things, because this is where I started. I was a super geeky, awkward kid, always overweight. My family didn't have financial resources. So for me, getting those things that I wanted took a lot of effort. It took always proving that I was better than someone else. I had to test higher than every other kid in my district to get into classes in elementary school. I had to beat out all the kids in my high school for a scholarship to go to University of Washington. But when I was there, something really amazing happened to me. Halfway through my sophomore year, I was one of 20 kids selected from the entire country for a fellowship from the U.S. Department of State. And overnight, I went from being this funky, overweight loser living in the dorms to having a fabulous apartment in Fremont, losing 40 pounds, getting a whole new wardrobe, and starting to travel the world. It was a life-changing moment for me. Suddenly, I had proof that someone out there thought that I was worthy of having this really cool thing. I got to be a member of Team America. Once I joined the Foreign Service, I had influence over U.S. government policy. I was managing millions of dollars in resources, and people wanted to talk to me. Everywhere I went, I could be certain that I was going to get an audience, because no one was going to turn down a representative of the U.S. government, right? And I did really well in this job. I got a lot of awards. I got everything that I wanted, or everything that I thought I wanted. I had my graduate degree from Georgetown. I had seen over 21 countries. And I had proof that someone out there in the world thought that I was important. But during my last overseas tour in Kabul, Afghanistan, I started to realize that that wasn't enough. I couldn't quite figure out what was missing, actually. I just knew that everything that I thought I believed in started to break down. My boss didn't like my work. I didn't get the validation from that group that I thought I wanted, and yet I still kind of believed somewhere deep down that I had something to offer. I had to, right? Otherwise, what was I gonna do? So I came back to Seattle. And I thought that when I showed up here with my fancy degree and all of my experience and all this cool stuff that I'd done, that people would like me, right? They would help me prove that my existence was valid. What happened was I fell flat on my face. I couldn't find a job. When I did get work, I kind of sucked at it, and I didn't understand what was going on. I started to blame Seattle. I thought, this place is my planet Krypton. These people don't get it. They're so provincial. They don't understand where I've been and who I am and what I've done. But all the attitude did was make me really, really miserable. And even after being here for a year, I still had PTSD. I still couldn't find work, and I still felt like a nobody. But then I had this insight, and it still gives me so much joy to share this with anyone who will listen, and I'm glad it's all of you. I realized that I didn't want to have to be the best at anything in order to be valid. In fact, I didn't want to be the best at all. It's not fun to sit on top of a pyramid looking down at your accomplishments and thinking about all the things that you've overcome in life. I wanted to be part of a community. In fact, the very community that made me decide to make Seattle my home in the first place. A community where there are no rules or performance standards. Because in order to innovate and create, you have to be willing to suck. You have to be willing to go without proof for a very long time. And that's when I understood that Seattle wasn't my planet Krypton. The whole time, I was carrying that kryptonite around inside of me. You see, by giving other people the right to decide whether I had superpowers, I also gave them the right to take that away. And now that I understand that what makes me powerful isn't what anybody thinks, I have the freedom to suck at whatever I want. That's what I gained when I lost my superpowers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Candace. So we're going to hear another story, this one about the kinds of unexpected things that can come at you and what you do. Please welcome to the stage, Randy Scott.
In 2010, my wife was pregnant with our second child. It was a pretty typical pregnancy, except till the very end, the baby was turned kind of funny, and despite our best efforts, we couldn't get her to flip over. The baby, not my wife. My wife was more than willing to flip over. There's a lot of information out there, by the way, on how to get a baby to flip over the natural way, and taking a door off the hinges and tilting it up on a cinder block and having your wife lay on it upside down doesn't work. Just thought I'd save you some time with that one. The September morning that we went into the hospital, we had every intention of leaving in a day or so with a perfectly healthy baby because the doctor scheduled a C-section to be on the safe side. Things didn't turn out exactly like we planned. On the morning the baby was born, everything got really serious. There was no, "Congratulations, it's a girl!" It was all this medical jargon that I didn't understand. And finally, I got the guts to say, "Will somebody please tell me what's wrong with my baby?" That's when the doctor looked at me and said, "Do you know what Down syndrome is?" And that's when I was first hit in the face with the shovel. I went reeling back, and I landed in this chair that I was really glad was behind me. I started shaking. I couldn't breathe. I felt like something was heavy on my chest. I started sobbing uncontrollably. Of course I knew what Down syndrome was, and it terrified me. But you know what scared me the most? What if I didn't love her as much because of this? It was my job to call everybody on our phone list and give them the news. 5 or 6 people down the list all said the same thing. "I'm so sorry." And then I got this guy. This is my father-in-law, Dan. And Dan said 6 words to me that changed my life. "I can't wait to meet her." Another shovel. Well, sort of. I mean, this one didn't hurt the same way. It just it knocked something loose in my heart. And I realized that in the room next door, there wasn't a diagnosis waiting for me. It was a baby. A little girl that I love so much that I thought my heart was going to burst out of my chest. And everything that I knew about Down syndrome came from other people. It came from doctors. It came from the media. It came from Wikipedia, not a place I recommend you go when you get any bad news. None of these stories were my story. I needed to retell my story, and it started with my oldest daughter, Tess. I needed to tell her that her sister was born differently, but instead, I got cake. Got the cake home, and Tess and I sang happy birthday at the top of our lungs to her baby sister who was still in the hospital. We celebrated because we didn't add a diagnosis to the family. We added Isabel Lucille. Here's the deal. You are going to take a shovel to the face. It is not a matter if, it is when. You lose a job, you get sick, a relationship goes south. You might have a child with a disability. You can't do anything about these things that happen to you, but you can control your story. Now, before you start thinking this is some kind of power of positive thinking, kumbaya stuff, it's not. There's actually research out there that says when people take control of their narrative and they retell their story, that later on they actually report higher levels of well-being. But how you tell your story is important. Now, I've stopped saying that my daughter's birth was like a shovel to the face. Now I think it was like this big, goofy, lovable dog came running towards me, knocked me over, and slobbered me. And that's what was on my chest and why I couldn't move. That's my story, my new narrative. And here's the awesome thing. You get to rewrite your narrative as well. It's yours. It's beautiful, it's sacred, it's personal, and it totally belongs to you. Don't let anybody else write a story onto you. When the whole world was telling me that having a child with a disability was a very bad, awful, horrible thing, I decided to rewrite it. But you know what the hardest part of this whole thing is? All the unlearning you have to do. Everything that I knew about intellectual disabilities was wrong. Lesson number one I learned, people with Down syndrome are just that. They're people. Down syndrome is not who or what my daughter is. Isabel is smart, she's beautiful, she's funny, she's incredibly loving. She's none of the words that sometimes people throw at you when they're talking about intellectual disabilities. Which leads me to my next point. If you're going to do this, if you're going to rewrite your narrative, have patience with yourself and with others. Because building a new narrative is a little bit like building a campfire. You don't just take a log and drop it on a match and expect it to go up in flames. You got to build it a twig at a time. And each time you tell your new narrative, your fire gets bigger. And eventually people won't be able to ignore it. Really, it's a choice. I could stand up here and I could tell you about the pain of being hit in the face with a shovel. Or I could tell you about this incredibly powerful love that knocked me over that I never saw coming. I'm picking love over a shovel to the face any day. Thank you.
So let's say you're building something cool and you want great feedback from people about it. How do you go about doing that? Our next speaker's got a pretty cool story about a cool thing you may have actually heard about. Please welcome to the stage, George Parentatos. George.
About a year ago, I joined the Fire Phone team at Amazon. And on my first day, my manager sat me down and said, George, you own the beta program. Okay, I said, having never run a beta program before in my life. Okay, so this is a secret product, George, so we can't show it to customers. Okay. But it's a phone, so people have to use it out in the real world and give us feedback, right? Yeah. All right, your problem now. Have fun. Great. So how do you get feedback on a product you can't hand to customers? Well, the answer to that is actually pretty simple. If you can't show this thing to customers, you give it to people who know about it, the people building the product. And hopefully they'll use it and give you some feedback and hopefully not do what that guy did, but that's a story for another time. So then the question is, how do you get really great feedback from people who are this close to the product, building it day in and day out? Let me tell you something about people working on a version one product. They're busy, they're tired, they're frazzled, they're working on code day and night, they've got meetings, deadlines, they're really tired, and at the end of the day, they probably don't want to work on the thing they worked on all day, at night, at home. So how do you convince these people, how do you motivate these people to give you great feedback that channels what customers think? Well, the answer I came up with was to make my beta program a game. I was fortunate to be on the Xbox team for a couple of years. We did not build this game. We built awesome games, and I learned firsthand how addictive games can be, trust me. So basically, I threw every gamification trick in the book I had at this problem, okay? So here are the rules. So every piece of feedback was a point. You have a leaderboard of points, you know, high scores and low scores. I had daily and weekly challenges like take the most pictures, listen to the most music. And most importantly, well, actually, I also had badges and virtual awards. Those are really important. They're worthless, but they're scarce. That's really important. You want one. I know you want one. Most importantly, anytime, day or night, you as a player could check exactly where you ranked on that leaderboard. And guess what? That actually worked. That motivated people. I know it worked because at one point, a 100-person meeting room was interrupted by a VP who realized he had beaten the high score of his arch nemesis. He stopped the room and he said, "Yes!" Games matter. Make it a game. Okay, so people are playing, but what happens when they get bored? And they will get bored. Well, I decided to add levels to my game. Are people tired of playing at work? Well, heck, have them use the thing at home. Have them take pictures of cats, dogs, pets, pigs. Have them make calls, conference calls. Have them triage email. Are they driving to work? Great. Every minute of use is a point. Have them use Bluetooth headsets. Have them do speech and turn-by-turn directions, right? Are people not giving you enough feedback out in the real world? Well, I decided to make a field trip challenge. We cram people into cars. We had them go into various parks in Seattle. And for hours on end, they would just walk around and use the phone. And actually, you saw some tech geeks walking around taking selfies for hours on end a few months ago. That was probably my fault. I hope I didn't creep anybody out. Sorry about that. So all of this really got us some great feedback. So people are playing. People are, you know, motivated, you know, you're adding levels, but is the feedback actually making it back to the people building the product? Well, that's important. And the way I solved that is I made sure those people watched the players play the game. So we got a room back at Amazon. We crammed it full of people, important people in the program, you know, VPs, directors, created. This is the room, by the way. It does not look awesome, but it was awesome. I'll tell you why. Stuffed it full of coffee and sugar. Gave a phone to each person and said, you know, use every feature of the phone one by one, write down your feedback on stickies, post them on the walls. Most importantly, though, every time a feature was used, we brought in the feature owners in that room, and they watched the group play the game. And guess what? If you have three or four people in that room arguing about how your feature should work, you're going to go back, and you're going to figure out how it's got to work, how it must work. So we did this actually for about 20 hours across multiple days. And it turns out it gave us a lot of great feedback, and it made the product a lot better. So eventually, we were able to show this product to customers, and we were able to get a lot of great feedback. But for a secret project like this, that doesn't happen until very late in the game. So these tips really helped us out and really made the product a lot better. But forget secret projects. If you're working on something that you want to get feedback from people who are not motivated to give you feedback, just follow these three steps. Make it a game, keep it fresh, and make sure people watch you play. Thank you.
Thank you, George. All right, so raise your hand if you have a cat. Okay, you're going to love this next talk, and I'm just going to leave it there. Please welcome to the stage McRae Nayers. McRae.
So this is what you get when you look up ruler of the internet. And honestly, is it that much of a surprise? Ever since the creation of social media and YouTube, cats have been at the forefront. People even make their own pages just for their cats. And in the end, this has created a new type of celebrity. There are now cat celebrities who are known for the most mundane of things, like fitting into a box that is definitely too small for them, or having a grumpy face. So despite the fact that Seattle is known for being a dog city, there are actually 3% more cat owners than there are dogs. But don't get me wrong, I love dogs. They're very sweet. They're generally a very excited animal. They're generally very excited about everything. They're excited to see you. They're excited to see food. They're excited to see balls. And cats, on the other hand, they're a little more fickle. Sometimes they're happy to see you. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they try incessantly to get your attention. And then once they've finally gotten it, they're like, how dare you pet me? How dare you touch me? But I think that's one of the reasons why we like cats so much, because we kind of have that in common. We don't give away our love freely. We make people fight for it. I don't walk into a party, hug a stranger, and drool all over them. Cats also have a super power. They actually heal. The frequency of their purr increases the healing of humans. They literally knit our bones back together faster. Our blood flow increases, and our risk of a heart attack is decreased by 40%. And despite the fact that animals are awesome, it's becoming an increasingly difficult thing to find an apartment that allows us to have them, not only in the U.S., but in the world. And that's why in 1997, a man in Taiwan created the world's very first cat cafe. So a cat cafe is kind of what it sounds like. It's a coffee shop with cats in it. And no, you can't bring your own. There are cats that live within the cafe. So you go in, you pay $10 to $15, you get a coffee, maybe a pastry, and you hang out with cats for about an hour or an hour and a half. And these are very comfortable. As you can see, there's comfortable for the cat, they're comfortable for the humans, there's toys, couches, sometimes you can even buy treats for the cats, but that usually gives you a little bit more attention than you want. And through the research that I've done and the interviews that I've read, even though sometimes you go and the cats ignore you, because let's face it, cats will do what they want, people still really enjoyed being in these because cats, they give out this aura of calmness. They do what they want, they relax, and you end up relaxing too when you're around all these relaxed creatures. So this next slide is going to be a map of all the cat cafes that are currently in Japan, which is the most significant amount. There's 62 cat cafes in Japan, and that's actually because only about 15% of the apartments allow you to have pets. And ever since about 2012, the rest of the world decided, why the crap don't we have these? And so the cat cafe boom was created. 6 months ago, the very first one opened up in London, Lady Dinah's Cat Emporium. A month ago, the first one opened up in Montreal. And within the next month or two, the first one is opening up in Australia. So what about the U.S.? The U.S.'s first cat cafe is opening up on the 25th of this month. I'm very excited. It's opening up in Oakland, California. They're actually partnering with a rescue, so you'll be able to adopt the cats if you so choose. So what about Seattle? Don't you guys think we need one too? Well, that's what I'm working on, actually. That's my goal right now. I'm trying to figure it out. A little bit of a difficulty. The goal is to have a cat cafe in the UW because a lot of college students are not allowed to have cats, so they're not allowed to have pets within their dorms, so we'll bring them to them. College is also a very stressful time, so I figured it'd be really good to surround them with calming creatures. This is about the general floor plan, so you get an idea of how cat fur isn't going to get in your pastries or your coffee, because I bet you're a little worried about that. If you can see here, the cafe and the cat area will be completely separated. That way, there'll be an area for the cats to be able to get to the food. We've already talked to a lot of people about this, and they're generally very excited, especially the shelters. They think that this is a great opportunity to educate you guys more on cats and how they socialize, and it's just a great way for us to show the world more cats, so thank you very much. If you want more information, see me at the break.
So we hear a lot these days about data. Data's the magic bullet. Data can solve everything. Just shoot some data at it. Our next speaker is going to tell you how that's a little more complicated than that. Please welcome to the stage Elizabeth Grigg.
Thank you. So you have a choice to make, and you want to be objective. So you decide you're going to make a data-driven decision. Now, what is a data-driven decision? This is a practice of using data to convince yourself and everyone else that you're doing the right thing. The promise is huge. No more sleepless nights, and your management will love you. But comprehensive data collection is a chicken move, and here is why. Half of the stuff you have no motivation to take care of in the first place, and the other half you have no control over. So only measure the data in the intersection of both. Eating a banana will get you 2 blue squares of radioactive units. Now, living in a concrete building for a year is 700 times worse, and that'll get you 3 green squares of radioactive units. Both of these are very small levels, and nobody ever gets sick from any of these activities. This is an example of useless data. I have an example for you about choosing a data-driven decision that I made, which was to choose the best streaming video service. And what I did is I chose the service that had the highest number of minutes watching and the lowest amount of minutes viewing. This is Anthony Bourdain earning himself 300 greens by visiting Chernobyl. What are you going to do? So this is an example of analysis paralysis. Some unnamed person at Microsoft is deciding whether to leave the company, so of course a spreadsheet is required. I'll share it out. Here's an example of purposefully obfuscating data in order to influence future decisions. So when it comes time to cut the budget, you'll never be able to cut out lattes because it's completely buried under entertainment. you know, making decisions used to be fun. You used to go out for an ice cream cone, and when you couldn't choose a flavor, you would get a little sample on those tiny little spoons, and if you were still indecisive, you could get another sample. But these days, we want the data to solve even our most important life choices. We want the data to pick our spouse for us. We want the data to do everything for us. Which brings us to internet surveys. So internet surveys is a common technique in organizations who are using data to fill the void in leadership. The reason why internet surveys are a cop-out is because of the observer effect. This is a tree falling in the forest. The observer effect tells us that when you try to look at the data, it changes out from under you. Which brings us to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Yes, it does. Now, Heisenberg, yes, he looked like that. Heisenberg studied the observer effect as it applies to physics, but it also applies to real-life decisions, such as how did you end up with a cranky personality type? It could be just because you did a difficult form online. Now, Heisenberg's buddy Schrodinger taught us to believe that the cat is neither alive nor dead, that it's unresolved. So what's the right balance to take when you're collecting data for your decision? Do you go with your gut, or do you seek external verification? Now, external verification can look like an act of humility, but it's actually an act of arrogance because you get so much noise that way and you cause so much noise as well. Let's talk about Zappos. Zappos doesn't worry about those chatty customer service calls affecting their bottom line. And Apple doesn't worry about those gratuitous animations affecting their performance. And they shouldn't collect data on those points. What they should measure is just the intersection of what you're motivated to take care of and what you have control over taking care of. And you can see that that was a much more pragmatic choice in terms of planning your data collection. Because leaders don't need noise in their data. They need small and salient data points in order to make decisions and rally the masses. So remember the radioactive banana hiding in your comprehensive data set. And remember how useless that information was. So learn from the banana and ignore the banana. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. There's a science for pretty much everything, including friendship. So if you ever thought you wanted to get better at making friends, you should stay tuned for our next speaker, Camille Shea. Welcome to the stage.
So, you're at a party and people are congregating to little groups, and you say to yourself, I'm going to mingle. Well, hopefully that's smooth sailing for you. But that doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes you crash and burn. Maybe nobody wants to listen what you have to say, because no matter how funny or clever your comments. Or even worse, maybe you get so nervous, all you can do is stare at the group, and your tongue goes on vacation, and they're creeped out. Well, this could be because you don't understand social rules. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that, but some of the biggest roadblocks are anxiety, or attention deficit, or increasingly, autism. But whatever the reason, it'll do a lot more to your life than just make you feel lousy at parties. If you don't know rules, it's hard to get a job, it's hard to find a roommate. God forbid you should get a date. In fact, if you're not clued in by the time you get to high school, you'll even have trouble finding friends. And that puts you at risk for depression and anxiety and substance abuse and all kinds of problems. Life just isn't very nice to you if you don't understand the rules. But the good news is that you can learn social rules just like you learn math and reading. There's a science behind friendship, and it's not rocket science either. You don't have to be a social butterfly. You just have to learn the same steps that everybody else uses, regardless if they're consciously aware of it. So tonight I'm presenting the four basic steps to entering a conversation. Now, the first step is simply to look. Look at the group. Is there somebody in there you know? If there is, that's really helpful. That increases your chances of being accepted. Okay? You're also going to look up at the group. Make brief eye contact occasionally, because that tells them that you're interested. You also want to look for signs the group is not open. If they're huddling together closely or they're whispering, that's a private conversation. And by the way, it's a good idea to look at a prop like your cell phone once in a while so you don't look like a stalker. Okay. Step two is to listen. You get within eavesdropping distance of the group you want to join, about 3 feet or so. And you're listening for the topic, so you know what the heck they're talking about, and you can join in. You listen for a friendly tone, because you don't want to jump into somebody's argument. And very important to listen for interests that you have in common with the group, because that's the basis of friendship. Step three is to wait for a pause or a transition or some sort of break where you can slip into the conversation. Now, there will rarely be a perfect pause, but that's okay. Just do your best to enter smoothly. Remember, you don't want to interrupt. So usually that will be at the end of somebody else speaking. So the fourth and final step to entering conversation is to actually join in. So now you want to move to about an arm's length away. Closer than that feels a little invasive. But you're going to make a short comment or ask a question, something to do with whatever the subject is, the topic is that they're discussing. And watch for feedback. People make eye contact, they smile, they direct conversation at you. That's a good indicator that you're in. But if that doesn't happen, don't be discouraged. Just move on, try with another group. Research shows that whenever anybody tries to join a conversation, they will be rejected roughly half the time. So the next time you're at a party, remember, look, listen, wait, and join in. You can jump in and mingle, because now you have a better idea of the social rules. If you want to learn more about social rules, please, this is my contact information. I'm Camille Shea. I'm an RN and certified peers provider, and my company is Clued In Social Skills. And thank you. You're a lovely audience.
Thank you, Camille. This is a region where a lot of people work at Microsoft. It's a region where a lot of people quit Microsoft. Not a lot of people quit Microsoft to do what our next speaker is doing. So please welcome to the stage Anushka Ren. Anushka!
Hi, everybody. So tonight I'm going to talk about why working at Microsoft was making me mentally ill and how bodybuilding saved me. Thank you. So when most people think of bodybuilding, they think of narcissists, they think of freak, they think of the person who's hogging the mirror at the gym, who's flexing and grunting. But when I think of bodybuilding, I think of the new bikini division. I think of discipline. I think of four-hour workouts. I think of workouts until you get a nosebleed. I think of the things that people don't know about that makes bodybuilding so amazing. I think of getting 7 meals in before 7 o'clock. Why do I know this? I know this because my first bikini competition, I became Miss Washington State Bikini Champion. And what does that mean? What does that mean? It means that I learned more from earning a $2 tiara about myself than I ever learned working 6 months at Microsoft. These are some other types of bodybuilding that you've probably never heard about. The bottom right, that's a fitness routine where people do 2-minute routines to music. So let's slow this down a little bit. I used to be a techie. I used to be like, hey, genius, we want you. I was working in the recruiting department. I was a hardcore Microsoftie. I had perceived power like you would not believe. I was straight out of my master's program, earning $80,000, okay, working with schools like Princeton, Princeton, Yale, Harvard. I was doing amazing things. I even helped plan the Bill Gates barbecue at his house. Hello. Okay? I had a nice car, but it didn't last, my friends. I was working in two time zones. I was getting so little sleep, working from 4 a.m. to 11 p.m., drinking way too much coffee. And as you guys well know, you know what that leads to. No sleep, plus gaining 40 pounds, plus calling the suicide hotline every day after work because that's what felt good to me. That leads to you going cray cray. I had no life. I lived in Seattle 3 years. I'd never seen the Space Needle. What do I know about mental illness? My dad was severely mentally ill, and by the time he died, I was the only person there to pack his apartment by myself, and I didn't want that for myself. I didn't want that for my husband, so I had to make a decision. Perceive power, money, whatever I wanted, or going after something and changing the direction of my life so I could stay mentally healthy. So I had some choices to make. I saved my money and I decided between Microsoft, mental illness, and me. And as you can imagine, I chose me. So with that savings, folks, I took the next 6 months off, and I did P90X. Booyah! I lost 35 pounds, okay? And that's all I did. And then a photographer discovered me, and she was like, you should be a bodybuilder. You look amazing. I was like, okay. But here's what, all jokes aside, here's what bodybuilding taught me. Bodybuilding taught me that sometimes you have to dance in the realm of the unknown. Sometimes you have to look like a fool. Sometimes you have to be ridiculed. Sometimes people have to look at you and be like, are you the rat lady who has pet rats? Because guess what? The bodybuilding stage led me to the public speaking stage. The bodybuilding stage gave me this confidence. Nobody needed to understand why I was acting like an Elvis impersonator, but the truth is, what's your passion? What are you interested in? What are you afraid to do? What are you missing out that other people are judging you for and saying, what? Don't let it happen. So I ask you three questions tonight. What if you could be anything you wanted to be? What if the world could be at your feet? What if you are the only thing standing in your way? Thank you, you guys. You've been such a great audience.
Thanks for wandering over to this podcast of Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. And if you enjoyed Ignite Seattle, think about giving your own talk. You'll find a link to submit your idea on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Ignite 26 is coming up on February 18th, 2015. The 25th Ignite Seattle took place at Town Hall Seattle on October 7th, 2014. The talks were moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.